Herpetiles, I think, roam every continent except Antarctica, and some can live to be, I know, over 100 years old. There are about 8,000 species in the world, and 50 of them happen to reside right here in Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to talk about reptiles and amphibians today and what you can do to help keep them around for many years to come. Bob Hay is an amphibian conservation specialist, retired Wisconsin DNR herpetologist, and Bob, it's been a long time, but great to have you back.
It's great to be back, Larry.
I really appreciate it. Let's start out by talking about, or maybe differentiate a bit between reptiles and amphibians.
Yeah, the big difference has to do with the scales on reptiles and the thin permeable skin on amphibians, which makes them more susceptible to drying out.
So that's the main difference. And by the way, before I go any further, I want to give the number for people to call in. You may have a question about reptiles or amphibians. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show, and maybe you have a cool picture of a reptile or an amphibian or maybe a question about the photo. I hope you'll post that on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And the herps are, some of them at least, are in danger here, according to the DNR, for sure. And I think you feel the same way.
Yeah, that's correct. There are 7 species of reptiles, 1 amphibian, and we've got a threatened species. One of the turtles is.
So we've got threatened, and there's terminology here that probably ought to...
Yeah,
straight now. There's threatened. There's endangered. Is that different from threatened?
An endangered species is one that's considered imperiled in the state. If action isn't taken, that animal is likely to disappear.
Okay.
A threatened species is declined from its pre-settlement kind of numbers, or at least what we've been able to observe in recent decades, and it is nearing endangerment, but it's not quite as bad off as the endangered species.
But sort of heading in that direction in a way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Are reptiles they in more danger than amphibians or the other way around? Or?
Yes, they are. In fact, if you look at we have 19 amphibians in the state and 36 reptiles. Of the 19 amphibians, we have 1 endangered species, and there are several that are special concern.
Uh-huh.
But on the reptile end, all but 1 of the endangered species are reptiles, and the 1 threatened turtle is a reptile, obviously.
Yeah.
So, and one of the big reasons for them having kind of this difference, at least we believe this is it, is that it takes reptiles a lot longer to reach sexual maturity in order to be reproductive.
Yeah.
So one of the extremes that I could offer you would be the endangered cricket frog, which can mature in a year. If its eggs are laid this year, next year it could be breeding. Same thing with some of the common frogs like spring peepers.
So those are amphibians, obviously. So
right, and they turn around pretty quickly. Where if you take the other extreme, which would be the Blanding's turtle, which used to be a threatened species, that animal can take 17 to 20 or more years to be old enough to reproduce.
Wow.
So just the sheer length of time is one issue. Another issue is the fact that if you look at their home range sizes, amphibians tend to stay fairly close to the wetlands where the eggs are laid and where they transform into small amphibians. And they usually are staying within several hundred feet, maybe a little bit beyond there. And so they've got a relatively small home range where a lot of the reptiles will travel great distances. This turtle I mentioned, the Blanding's turtle, is known to move up to 1.5 miles or more from water to lay its eggs. And they have what they call nest site fidelity, which means typically where they hatch is where they want to go and lay their eggs when they mature. So a lot changes in the landscape over a period of 20 years. And when they're trying to go back, it's tougher to get there.
Find a parking lot there where you were born, sort of. Yeah.
So there's those are the big major differences there.
And, you know, we had an email question from Russ in Madison who says, I'm on the Madison area bike trails through the Nine Springs E-Way, and We're getting toward that time of year when the cold-blooded critters will be taking advantage of the warm asphalt after a cool night, and this is a dangerous habit for snakes, particularly the little brown species, as they like to stretch out that comfy trail and look just like, almost like small twigs. What do you do to slow down the slaughter?
Well, I'm glad you asked the question. It's a great question, Russ. And the key really is awareness. Just helping bikers, particularly in the month of September and early October, when we have these warm, sunny days and these animals are out trying to seek the last heat they can get before they enter hibernation for the winter. And there is a lot of slaughter that goes on bike trails and on roads at that time of the year because of the warm asphalt. In a vehicle, it's a lot less, a lot more difficult to see things. In on a bike trail, if you're paying attention to the surface that you're driving along, it's a little easier to see that. But nonetheless, we still see a lot of mortality, and there's really not anything practical to do other than increase the awareness that it is causing problems for them. Fortunately for those species, they tend to be fairly numerous. They're an abundant species relative to some of the others. So that mortality, you know, we see that year after year, have been seeing it for decades. And in most places, you continue to see that mortality, which suggests that they have the capability of overcoming some of that mortality just by their own life history and be able to reproduce.
At least that's the better news, at least. Of course, it doesn't help the ones that are
no, it doesn't
run over by bikers or by automobiles. Sue in Mequon has a question for you. Hi, Sue. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a little stream next to my house that's always had frogs in it, and our yard has always had quite a few toads. In the last couple of years, the frogs have really been invading the entire yard area, and I feel like the toads are getting elbowed out. I really have not done any kind of a count, but that's my impression. Do they share territory like this?
Yes. Frogs in general are not territorial except when for a few species when they're breeding. They tend to set up their little calling stations near in the water. And what you're seeing is animals that have probably transformed from the tadpole stage, and now they're up on the land where they're feeding on insects. And what's interesting, and I didn't mention this earlier about the difference between reptiles and amphibians, is that amphibians have extremely high reproductive capability. So an American toad can lay thousands of eggs, a single female, every year. And if you got a number of them that do that, you oftentimes will see a huge flush of tadpoles, or excuse me, these little metamorphic toads, usually in about mid-June. And then a little bit later, you'll also see leopard frogs or green frogs coming out from these same habitats. And to me, that spells good news. Now, I know that it's horrible when you're trying to mow your lawn and you're trying to dodge these things and you hope they get out of harm's way. But what's interesting about that is that they wouldn't be there if there wasn't a food supply for them. So a couple of good things that are going on. The stream is obviously clean enough to support them. It has enough food for the larva, and also there's enough insects, at least for a while, for those animals to really thrive on land. So when I hear people talking about frogs overtaking your yard, it makes me smile because it sounds to me like, for them, a success story, at least on a micro scale. So
that's pretty cool.
Okay, I won't worry about the toads then. I guess No. They're on their own. Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Sue. Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, Jean in Eau Claire. Jenny, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a I need some direction. I have a waterfall with a pond at the bottom, and I live kind of in the woods. And each year I get a frog. I'm very lucky, I think. I get a frog who adopts my pond and lives there during the summer. And my question is, I never have known what to do at the end of the season because I pump out my pond, and what should I do with the frog? Do I just take him out and set him back in the woods, or leave him at the bottom of the empty pond? I mean, it's probably about 4 feet deep, but I pump most of it out. So I really need direction on what to do with my frogs. I don't want them to die out.
Actually, it sounds like what you're doing is the best thing for them. Typically, frogs will move to smaller ponds to take up residency and just feed around the perimeter. And in the fall, oftentimes they'll migrate away from a pond like that to a nearby wetland or stream. And the fact that it showed up in your pond means that there's got to be another population somewhere nearby. So I think the safe thing of draining your pond gives that animal, especially if you do it early enough in the year. So typically if you've got your pond down by, let's say, early October, those animals will usually experience enough warm weather to be able to move to better facilities. Now, I don't know what species we're talking about here. There are some...
He's a pretty big guy. He's probably about 3 to 4 inches long, and he's kind of brownish green in color. And to be honest, he's the biggest frog that I've had so far. I usually have something that's about, oh, maybe 2, 2.5 inches. But this is kind of a bigger fella, and I just want to do the right thing. So you think
sure.
it would be best to just set him out, because I take the fish out, and then I just set him out in the woods? Or
yeah, I think that would be fine. It sounds like you've got a green frog, and that animal's probably become an adult.
Oh,
so they're quite common in the state. They're found in every county. But, yeah, helping them out by just moving them out of the pond once you drain it and let them decide what they need to do. They do overwinter in the water, so they're going to go somewhere where they're able to survive.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you so much for your help. I just wanted to do... I know they're getting precious, the frogs, and I just wanted to help them along. So thank you so much for your guidance.
Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you, Jenny, for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Bob Hay. Bob's an amphibian conservation specialist, retired Wisconsin DNR herpetologist, talking with him today about herpetiles, the reptiles and amphibians, getting an update. He's also director of a nonprofit group. It's called Turtles for Tomorrow, and we're going to find out about that as well. In the meantime, you can join us. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page if you have a photo, an amphibian or reptile photo. We'd love to see that. And a question, just go to our Facebook page, the title of the Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 11:45 today, we're going to talk about some special opportunities that are available to you to learn and in cooperative extension with the University of Wisconsin Extension. So I look forward to that. Rick Clemmy will be stopping by. Right now, though, visiting with Bob Hay about reptiles and amphibians. And certainly, if you have questions, call in at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Bob, as I mentioned earlier, you direct a nonprofit group called Turtles for Tomorrow. Tell us the background. How did this get started?
Well, I retired in 2009 from the DNR, mainly because I couldn't get my work done there anymore. I continued to do some of the projects that I had been coordinating. I'd mm-hmm. pretty much hired people to do after I retired, and I did some work for several years on contract with the DNR.
Mm-hmm.
And the funding for that became kind of difficult for them to acquire, and so I was... My old supervisor actually said, you know, you probably need to find another way to make this happen. So I started my nonprofit in 2012, and we really got up and running later that year, and we've been running ever since then. So it's been a way, and if you look at the title, Turtles for Tomorrow, we focus on rare turtle conservation, and primarily we do that for several reasons. Number one is that there's not a whole lot we can do for the other reptiles of the state. They don't provide as many conservation opportunities as turtles do. And it's kind of related to nesting, and a lot of times it's related to habitat. So on a statewide perspective, we can probably accomplish a lot more for turtles. They're also the slowest to mature of all the species of reptiles. So they've got a lot working against them, and as a lot of folks know, a lot of turtles are killed on the road every year as a result of them leaving the water to go and nest on land. And they also, we've seen an increase in predator populations, particularly the raccoons, that just devastate the nesting sites.
And you're working on, you've got some specific projects. I think ornate box turtle, I think, is one you're working with. And
that's correct.
A Blanding's
turtle? We do work with Blanding's turtles, even though they're no longer listed as a threatened species. We're doing a long-term study to try to look at the effectiveness of head starting on as a conservation strategy.
So what does that mean?
Head starting is a method where we collect eggs from wild turtles from a given population. We hatch those artificially in captivity, and then we raise the turtles for a period of about 10 to 11 months to grow them to a size that will make them less vulnerable to predators. So a typical Blanding's turtle, when we release it, would be a little bigger than 4 inches.
Okay.
Where coming out of the egg, they're about an inch and an eighth, and their shells are very soft. So these turtles have well-formed shells, and they're the equivalent of about a 4 to 6 year old Blanding's turtle when we release them. So they've got firmer shells.
Very good.
So we're trying to study this with many years to try to see how many of these animals actually make it to maturity. So it's a long-term study for an animal that has a very slow maturity rate.
Yeah, but it's the kind of thing that, I mean, is so valuable in the long term.
Well, what's interesting about that, you get that question a lot. What about this? What's the value of this or that? And we don't always understand the value, but what's been interesting over the years is to watch how scientists begin to understand more and more the different things that are available. Now, typically what we hear about are things that are beneficial to humans. We don't really understand a lot about the interactions between species and why there's so much diversity out there. And we have to believe that the diversity itself creates long-term stability. So populations of everything rise and fall.
Sure.
And so I would argue that the Blanding's and any other reptile or amphibian out there and every other creature probably has a unique need, or it probably wouldn't exist.
Yeah, and the you work with wood turtles as well, if I remember.
I do indeed. Yeah, I actually spend most of my time working in northern Wisconsin on wood turtles.
And what is that form, or what does that take, that research? Form does it take? I'm sorry.
Right now what we're doing is we're focusing on the development of nesting sites for wood turtles. We had done a lot of work when I was working at the agency and after I was working there to get a better understanding of how nesting was working out for wood turtles. And in the northern part of the state, there's been very little attention paid to maintaining or managing for nesting sites. And as a result of that, and I'm talking about mostly the northern third of the state that's primarily forested, the huge majority of nesting sites are located at bridge crossings or where you have a stream that's close to and parallel to a road, and the turtles will come out and oftentimes nest along the road. And you create this linear pattern for predators to just walk the shoulders
down
of the road
and
dig them up.
Yeah.
But the even worse problem is that we're seeing a lot of adult females killed on roads.
Oh, sure.
And the experts say that with reptiles, you need to have less than 3% annual adult mortality in order to maintain the populations of slow to mature, long-lived animals.
That's not very much. That's not a very high percentage.
It's a very low percentage.
Yeah.
And it needs to be even lower than what it is. So.
Well, so that's some really interesting work. Dorothy and Presque Isle has a question for you, so let's go to Dorothy. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, very good show again today. We're on a small lake up in Presque Isle, and we always have, every year, we have a log that is floating out in our lake, and we have 10 to 12 turtles on it all the time, and they just love sitting out there. We were talking to, and we don't have any this year, we were talking to a neighbor, and he's on the opposite end of the lake, and he happened to mention, he said, I don't know what happened. He said, I always have all sorts of turtles on that log up by his house. And he said, I don't have any at all this year. And we're just wondering, how does that happen? What could happen to them?
That's a great question, and one that I'll do my best to try to explain what may be going on. It's a little bit difficult to know for sure, but you're probably talking about adult turtles, or at least juveniles or in adults. And there's a possibility that the lake that they're on experienced what we would call winter kill. It oftentimes affects fish. And I don't know anything about the lake that you're referring to relative to fish. But the other thing that could be happening, and this does happen periodically, is we'll hear about a lot of turtle mortality, usually in the spring. And it's usually a few weeks after the ice goes out when the water warms enough and the shells start to decompose, or the bodies of the turtles decompose, and those turtles literally float to the surface and oftentimes get washed to the shore. And we're thinking that in those instances, it could be either they're being depleted of oxygen or they are over-oxygenated. It's not very often you get a hyper condition with oxygen, but it can happen. But disease can also play a role in taking out a local population, or at least having a significant impact.
Very interesting. So, but, you know, they can come back, right, Bob? Are they, over time, the turtles will come back?
Well, I would say if you went back 80 to 100 years, the answer would be yes. And today, these, what we would call kind of a local catastrophic event, the recovery of those populations is really in question because of the predation rate and the mortality rate that's associated with roads. Now, painted turtles don't wander as far from the water as the blandings do, but they are looking for a sunny place usually to lay their eggs. They also nest along road shoulders. I've seen many of them when I'm doing my wood turtle work. I do see a fair amount of mortality of that species, but generally speaking, they're very abundant. But when you have a local die-off, especially if it takes a majority of adult females out of there, your chances of recovery are probably
a lot lower.
You may see more turtles in the future, but whether they would ever be able to recover, even the greatest, most well-known turtle scientists in the country think that all species are in decline and will continue to decline if we can't address some of the major issues that are resulting in their decline. So disease may be just one of them, and winter kill is kind of a natural phenomenon, particularly in northern Wisconsin. So it does happen periodically, and turtles have been able to sustain that, but their numbers with all the other odds may make that less likely to happen, at least as quickly.
So there you go, Dorothy. Thank you so much for calling. Not the best news in the world.
That was a good answer, though. Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Dave and Brewell, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning, Larry. Morning, Bob. Dave up in Brewell here. You've got the two sanctuaries up here on our property. I'm looking at one of them right now. Oh, I have not seen any young of the year. I'm just curious. I'm like, should I still be kind of monitoring to see whether or not we get any wood turtles up here, or would it be too late for that?
That's a great question, Dave. It's actually not too late. In fact, in dealing with the biologist up there out of Brule, he has seen a fair number of wood turtles hatch from some of the other sites. And we're thinking that because you're a little bit lower and your soil is a little different than what we use in some of the other nesting sites that we've created, it may take a little bit longer for them to emerge. But the good news is he had wood turtles coming out as early as the first week in August. And last year, many of those nests didn't make it because it was such a cool, wet year. So I suspect that if you're going to get the weather we're going to get next week, you should see emergence from those turtles.
Okay, great. I mean, I'll keep my eyes open. The other good news, if there is any in the whole turtle world here, I saw three a lot farther away from here that just this morning I was fishing on the river and saw three that I have never seen them there before, downstream toward Lake Superior.
Good.
Very good. Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dave, for calling. I appreciate it. We have on Facebook a photo here that was sent by Carl. A really nice color photo of a frog. He says, this frog is in my mother's pond this weekend. What kind is it? And it's a pretty green one.
Yeah, that frog looks to me like a bullfrog. And the reason that I identified as a bullfrog rather than a green frog is there's a little ridge that runs from behind the eye and wraps around the tympanic membrane, that little pad on the side of the face that looks a little bit like a target. It's got a little bit of a brown with a green center. When that fold wraps around the tympanic membrane, that is one of the key indicators of a bullfrog. If it was a green frog, that fold would not wrap around, but it would run down the back of the frog toward the hind quarters, and it tapers out toward the end. But that's the easiest way. Now, the other thing is that bullfrogs tend to be, they are the largest frog in the state. They can reach 6, even 7 inches in length, just snout vent. So they're a large frog. This animal could be a large one. I'm seeing it's on a lily pad. I'm not sure how big that pad is, but it looks like a pretty good-sized frog, and it could not even be in a full-size adult at this point.
Yeah, that's a pretty, very nice photo. This is good to see. Thanks a lot, Carl, for sending it. And as Bob says, it is not a green frog. It is a bullfrog, and they're fun to listen to.
Oh, they sure are. Yeah, I don't hear them very often because their distribution is really spotty.
Yeah.
We don't have many in the Madison area.
But when you hear one, they're pretty easy to identify, and they're a lot of fun to hear. We had someone wondering if you could address the danger of handling reptiles with, like, bug spray on your hands and things like that.
Oh, that's a great question. I actually have a firsthand experience with that was not very pleasant, and I was younger when this happened. We were out collecting some amphibians for a state fair exhibit years ago, and it was a hot day in July, and the mosquitoes were horrific. We were working in a lowland hardwood forest, which you can imagine is crawling with mosquitoes, and we had doused up pretty good with bug juice because of the situation with them, and we captured several species that day, including wood frogs, which are typical in that habitat. And by the time we got back to our vehicle, I opened up the container, and some of the frogs were already dead, and the other ones really looked sick. And we realized that we had contaminated them just with the layer that we had on our hands was obviously transferred to their skin. And it resulted in quick mortality. So that is a real concern. I always, when I'm doing programs, especially with children, we're talking about amphibians, I always try to remind them that you never want to touch these animals if you have bug spray on your skin at all. Wash your hands. And reptiles seem to be less susceptible, although I'm not going to say that they're not affected by it. It just doesn't seem to display itself as quickly. And it has to do probably with the fact that they've got scales over their skin and obviously the shell. With snakes, it's be the same thing.
So that's a really, really, really good thing to bring up. I'm glad whoever it was called in to ask that question, so it gave Bob a chance to discuss it. I do want to, and there's so many things here to talk about, but I want to change gears just a minute to talk about rattlesnakes. I kind of misspoke here earlier in the show. I said you train rattlesnakes. You don't train rattlesnakes. You train people to handle rattlesnakes. That's more like it.
Yeah, that's correct. I've never figured out how to train a snake. They kind of do what they want to do, and rattlesnakes do the things you don't want them to do. So I do train, and I have in the past. I've done several classes for the new warden recruits with the DNR. I did that for a while when I worked with the DNR, and I have done some since then. I also work with landowners who have rattlesnakes on their property, and they don't really want them in their front yard, but they realize that they're valuable and they don't want to kill them. So I train them how to handle them and what to do to move them to safety and how to actually harass them in an effective way without harming them, but will allow that animal to be able to know that this location is associated with danger, and they rarely come back. And that was actually demonstrated through a study done with the Eastern Massasauga rattlesnake in Ontario. They have a really huge outreach program for that endangered species there. And it's been effective there, and it seems to work well here.
So there's it takes a little training to do that, though, to learn how to
harass them. The harassing part is pretty easy. Usually what I recommend to people is if you don't want to approach the animal very closely, but if you see an animal that's persisting or if you just see it in the yard and you don't want it there, the safest thing to do if you've got access to a hose is to turn on the water and let that water just spray out the nozzle and so that you're not blasting it with hot water.
Right.
If it's been sitting in the sun. And then just literally drive the animal away. You don't have to get close to it. But that harassment, they hate that water hitting them like that, and it drives them away. I have a fellow that I did that with three rattlesnakes out in Iowa County, and he is a real advocate now for them, but he has not had them show up and be a problem. So it does work.
Well, so you are kind of training rattlesnakes in a way.
Well, yeah, okay, there you go, Larry. You got me.
Well, that's pretty cool because I did have... On a couple of occasions, I've had people call the show and say, "Doggone it! I've got on my lawn rattlesnakes, and I go to mow the lawn. I'm worried about the snakes, or I'm worried about myself." And so that's a great idea and a great way to solve that problem.
Now, one thing a lot of folks may not know is that we have five species in the state that we kind of colloquially call rattlesnake mimics. They shake their tails to warn people. And people sometimes, especially if you put the animal in a bucket or if they're up against the siding of a house, it'll make a noise when the tail tip hits the object. And we've never tested it with those non-venomous animals, but I would assume that...
The same thing.
There's the common sense thing that the wildlife has is that when there's danger, you flee it and you don't return. So I would think that method would work for almost all of the snakes.
Very, very cool. Jerry in Shell Lake has a question. Hi, Jerry. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you. The other day, I experienced one of the funniest things. I have a five-step stairway to my porch, and there was a toad, 2-3-inch toad, on the porch. I said, "No, you shouldn't be here." I put him back out in the yard. A few hours later, he's back on the porch. I said, "No." I put him back out in the yard. A couple hours later, he's at the bottom of the stairs looking up.
Jerry, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
What time of the day was that?
Afternoon. Middle of the day.
It's possible that animal was moving into where it was going to forage at night. If you ever have lights on your porch, it will draw a tremendous amount of insects, and believe it or not, these amphibians have learned, tree frogs and toads as well, to come and dine. I was at a place this spring where there were several toads and a whole bunch of tree frogs on the side of a building, and the lights were swarming with insects. So that it's possible that's what it was about.
Ah, there you go.
Are they pretty tough climbers, though?
They jump.
The tree frogs can climb up almost anything because of the suction cups on their pads of their toes. Toads are not climbers per se, but they can hop, and they can use their legs to pull themselves up. They're going to do whatever they have to do to get to the food. That's what keeps them alive.
Do I want to make sure he's on the dirt, though, back on the yard eventually?
I would say that if you just remembered that he could be on your front porch and you just took precautions when you go out the door, otherwise I wouldn't be concerned about him. He's coming. He's probably getting a great meal.
And he knows what to do.
He knows what to do.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jerry. Appreciate your call. We have more callers online. But I do want to go back to Turtles for Tomorrow for a minute because that organization, have you got a website or talk? I'm sure we have a link to it on our Facebook page. But
yeah, if you just Google Turtles for Tomorrow as one word or as three words, it'll take you to a link there. TurtlesForTomorrow.org is the formal name, and it's a charitable organization, and we primarily work with ornate box turtles, which is an endangered species, and we work with the development of these nesting sites for wood turtles. And one thing I didn't mention about the wood turtles is that the only way we found to effectively improve their hatch rates is to put low electric fences around there that keep the predators out.
Oh.
So we now have 11 of those sites out. We've got 19 sites in all. We have 11 sites that have electric fences, and we're actually monitoring four of those this year to look at the difference between hatch rates between no predators and predators, and it's phenomenal. So we're seeing wonderful results from using electric fences, and they're primarily to keep raccoons out.
And so some of that's so interesting. I can remember being involved with some DNR folks with exclosures that are such a revelation to see in the, you know, in a woods where you've got an area that was fenced off the deer couldn't get to.
Yep.
The difference in the vegetation there versus the rest of the area. It's amazing, and this sounds like something sort of similar in a way.
Yeah, it gives the turtles a chance to do what they need to do without interference. So we're hoping to slowly rebuild populations by at least allowing their eggs to hatch.
Eric in Madison, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, I just had your discussion about bullfrogs earlier reminded me of my undergraduate days in the forest and wildlife ecology department. Scott Craven can probably verify this, but there is a specimen of a huge bullfrog in preserved in a jar of ethanol in the department. That was the story was that there was a farmer that was watching a group of newly hatched ducklings on his pond. And he kept noticing that they kept dropping in number, like almost every day. Like one would disappear, and then there'd only be a couple left, and then so he went out there and watched, and he actually caught. It was a bullfrog that was eating the ducklings, and he actually caught it, or he saw it happening, and had a handy 2x4, I guess, and smashed the bullfrog on the side of the head. And so in the jar in the department is a large bullfrog with smashed inside of the head with the duckling still in its mouth.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. I have not seen that one.
It was, it's in Russell Labs. At least that's where it was last time I saw it years ago. But ask Scott about that. He was the one that told me that story.
Yeah,
the clap.
That's a great, they're amazing predators when they're adults. They have huge mouths, and anything they can fit in them, they'll eat.
Well, you know what? This has been so much fun. And I tell you, you and I were talking before the show about how quickly the time went the last time you were on. And here we are again, where things have gone by really, really quickly with lots more questions here, Bob. So obviously you're going to have to come back sooner than later. And we'll do this all over again. Love to have you back.
It would be my pleasure. It's been fun.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun. And again, Bob's organization is called Turtles for Tomorrow. And doing a lot of really cool work. We have a link to it. I mean, just type it into the Facebook page. We have a link on our Facebook page. Or just type Turtles for Tomorrow into your search engine, and it's going to pop up, and you're going to learn how you might become a member of Turtles for Tomorrow, or maybe even get involved in one way or another.